Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour,
how does privatization amount to a constitutional coup?
And first, how did corporations get civil rights? That's the question of our next guest. He says that the corporate rights movement began as early as 1809 with Alexander Hamilton's Bank of the United States case. That was followed by an advancement of corporate rights in 1882 when a former senator named Roscoe Conkling argued that corporations should get the same protections under the U.S. Constitution as people received. Despite the fact that the winning argument was built on falsehoods, it stuck. And since then, corporations have been winning rights that were meant for individuals who had been suffering without them. How did this corporate rights movement happen? What has it meant for U.S. politics? With us is Adam Winkler. He's a professor of law at UCLA and the author of books including Gunfight and his latest, We the Corporations. Welcome back to the Scholars Circle. It's great to have you here with us, Adam Winkler.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with Roscoe Conkling.
Well, Roscoe Conkling was an illustrious lawyer in the late 1800s, who in the 1880s led a remarkable series of test cases on behalf of the Southern Pacific Railroad, seeking expansive new rights for business corporations under the 14th Amendment. And Conkling had been a leader in the Republican Party in Congress for decades, had even been nominated and confirmed to the Supreme Court himself, but turned down the seat after being confirmed the last person ever to turn down a Supreme Court seat after winning a confirmation vote in the Senate. Part of the reason was he was making too much money as a lawyer for the Southern Pacific Railroad. And Conkling went to the Supreme Court and argued that the 14th Amendment, which was adopted after the Civil War to protect the rights of the newly freed slaves, was also adopted to protect business corporations from discriminatory state taxes and regulations. And Conkling had unusual credibility in making this argument. Not only is he a person who had been nominated to the Supreme Court himself, but he had been a drafter of the 14th Amendment. And it turns out that historians now know that Roscoe Conkling had lied to the Supreme Court about the history of the drafting of the 14th Amendment.
But the court believed it. So deceit won here. And you said maybe this was because of personal factors. You think it's his relationships? What do you think that was?
Well, and strangely, the Supreme Court never ruled on Roscoe Conkling's case directly, held onto it for 3 years without ever issuing a final opinion. And then the case unexpectedly settled, which was odd because it was a test case designed to get a Supreme Court opinion. But another one of the Southern Pacific 60 test cases, long before the NAACP was filing for their test cases to combat desegregation, the railroads were fighting test cases to win 14th Amendment rights for them. And another one of the Southern Pacific cases made it up to the Supreme Court a couple years later. And the Supreme Court eventually said that corporations do have rights under the 14th Amendment. And over the next few years would protect corporations far more than the Supreme Court would protect African Americans, the amendment's intended beneficiary.
One of the things that I thought was fascinating in your book was where you describe the process of gaining rights for corporations contrasted to how people have had to get their rights. So for people, it took mass mobilization. But this was not the case for corporation. It was a hidden movement. And then it co-opted the rights and the cases that were used for people to get their rights. How would you describe this process?
That's right. When we think about how women and racial minorities gained constitutional protections and gained equal rights, we have this idea of a sort of a civil rights movement, you know, where people march in the streets and they engage in public advocacy to win over the hearts and minds of we the people and to fulfill the promise of the Constitution. But of course, corporations don't march in the streets and they don't carry around signs demanding equal rights, but they have fought for 200 years in the Supreme Court, seeking landmark rulings extending fundamental constitutional protections to them. And in some ways, the corporate rights movement, if you will, has been more successful for a longer time than the civil rights movement or the women's rights movement. For instance, the first Supreme Court case on the rights of African Americans was decided in 1857. The first Supreme Court case on the rights of women under the Constitution was decided in 1873. But the first Supreme Court case on the rights of corporations under the Constitution was decided in 1809, a half century earlier. And unlike women and minorities who lost most of their Supreme Court cases up until the 1950s and 60s, corporations have amassed a remarkable track record of winning an ever-increasing share of our fundamental rights.
Another thing that I thought was fascinating that was a theme throughout your book was that political scientists, and I'm a political scientist, we have looked at Supreme Court decisions and looked largely at ideology as one of the major factors. You know, are they liberal? Are they conservative? But you've sort of busted that open and said that despite whether they are liberal or conservative ideologically, there's another ideology that really doesn't fit in this. How would you describe that?
You know, the truth is we think of justices in terms of liberal or conservative, but what unites justices over the course of American history has been that the court's largely been pro-business, whether the majority is liberal or whether the majority is conservative. And the history of the constitutional rights of corporations is a story of odd bedfellows, where it was sometimes liberal courts like the New Deal and Warren courts of the early to mid-20th century, so the mid to the mid-20th century, that really invigorated the rights of corporations in a variety of ways. And oddly enough, it was Ralph Nader who won one of the landmark Supreme Court cases that really laid a foundation for Citizens United, which might seem the exact opposite of anything that Ralph Nader, the consumer rights advocate, would be seeking to achieve. And surprisingly, it was sometimes conservative Supreme Courts, like the business-friendly Lochner Court of the early 20th century, that imposed new limits on the rights of corporations and refused to extend to corporations rights of political speech and rights of freedom of association to turn down customers for businesses, some of the same rights that corporations seem today to be getting from the Supreme Court.
So let's break some of this down. One is the idea that some of these pro-business courts, like the Lochner Court, and another example that you gave in the book was the Roger Taney, who is awful for human rights, civil rights for people, but had some qualms about corporations having rights. And then there was the piece about Ralph Nader and how that's been sort of turned on its head. So let's start with the Lochner Court, Roger Taney. How does this make sense, if at all? And what was it that they opposed?
Between like 1890 and 1937 is a period in the Supreme Court's history that historians call the Lochner era. And the court was pretty business friendly at this time, building on Roscoe Conkling and the Southern Pacific Railroad's victory in winning 14th Amendment rights for corporations. The Supreme Court read the Constitution broadly to protect corporations from a variety of different kinds of business regulations. But the court back then did draw a line and a boundary on the rights of corporations. So corporations do have rights of property. They need to protect their property rights and their assets from being seized by the government. But at the same time, corporations don't have rights of liberty under the Constitution, rights that you might describe as associated with personal conscience or political freedom. And so back in the early 20th century, 100 years before Citizens United, the courts universally upheld restrictions on corporate spending in elections, saying that elections are not a place where corporations have rights. That's a liberty right. And 100 years before the Masterpiece Cake Shop wedding cake case before the Supreme Court on whether a baker can refuse to sell a wedding cake to a same-sex couple, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations could not claim a constitutional right to refuse to do service with certain kinds of customers. So at one point, some of the same issues that we see today came up before the Supreme Court long ago.
And then you mentioned Ralph Nader's case getting really essentially flipped around to, rather than prevent the corporations from being able to trample on consumer rights, being turned to then grant corporations better rights. How did that happen?
Well, one of Ralph Nader's most remarkable and lasting achievements was a major Supreme Court victory in the mid-1970s in a case called Virginia Pharmacy. And what Ralph Nader did was, on behalf of consumers, was able to get the Supreme Court to strike down laws that restricted the ability of pharmacists to advertise the price of prescription drugs. And Nader was doing this not to help the pharmacists, but to help the consumers who wanted to be able to comparison shop but weren't allowed to get the access to the information that they would need. That case, however, adopted a very specific theory of the First Amendment, that because Ralph Nader was seeking to protect consumers, the Supreme Court said that the rights of listeners were valuable in the First Amendment. And regardless of the identity of the speaker, and the rights of the speaker, that the consumers and the listeners of the information had rights that were protected by the First Amendment. That same theory would be used by the Supreme Court in Citizens United when it would say that the identity of the speaker was irrelevant, and the fact that a corporation was spending money on elections was not a basis to limit it, so long as the speech was valuable to listeners.
Now, if we were to back up and go into American history in the early days and how this came about, you've sort of challenged a narrative of what the founding of the United States was about, and you brought in the idea that really it was a pilgrimage of a corporation initially, the Virginia Company. How would you describe this, and what is the effect that you think it's had?
Well, we have the story that we are told as school children about the pilgrims who go to Plymouth, and they're sort of the perfect embodiment of the American spirit, resistance against tyranny, seeking to exercise their fundamental rights of religious freedom and self-governance, really a symbol of what America would become. But of course, the first permanent English colony in the New World was in Jamestown 13 years before the pilgrims came. And Jamestown was a business affair. It was a money-making venture, a trading corporation, one of the Virginia Company of London, which organized the expedition and established the colony, was a business corporation that sold stock in London. And many of the reforms that the Virginia Company undertook, such as the first representative assembly in the 16-teens, was really not a progressive statement of principles of democracy, but it was a reform designed to encourage more people to move to the colony so that the company could make more money. So the profit-seeking corporation was as much a part of the founding of America as the pilgrims asserting their religious freedom and battle against tyranny.
And then you said the Constitution had roots in these companies.
One of the most surprising things I found is that there were clear linkages between our Constitution and the corporate charters of the early colonies. So many of the early colonies, like Jamestown, like Virginia, were organized around a corporate charter. The corporate charter was given by the king, and the charter would establish as a written document what the officers of the company could do, what the rights of investors were, when the investors could vote, what were the limits of the office holders' powers. And those documents became not just governing documents for the colonial corporations, but became governing documents for the colonies themselves as sort of political documents. And over time, as the colonies grew and evolved into more traditional kinds of government, they retained this connection to these written documents that clearly specified the powers of office holders and recognized things like individual rights and established things like the right to vote. So there's elements of our Constitution that really stretch back into our corporate heritage.
So that said, some of the famous founders were quite worried about concentration of wealth and power, Jefferson, Madison, George Mason in particular, but others were on the other side. Could you walk us through the debates at the time that related to corporations and corporate rights?
Well, there were significant debates right from the get-go. I mean, so when the founders debated the Constitution, they never considered whether corporations would have rights under the Constitution the way individuals do. It just never came up. It never was discussed. But the issue came up very quickly in the courts, in part arising out of a battle between Jefferson and Hamilton and their famous battle over the Bank of the United States. The Bank of the United States was established by Congress, but it was a private corporation with stockholders and amenable to the stock market, the stockholders. And the bank was the richest and most powerful corporation in America, with branches from Boston to New Orleans. And the bank and the dispute between Jefferson and Hamilton is famous for giving rise to the two-party system. But it also gave rise to the first Supreme Court case on the rights of business corporations, because Jeffersonians tried to tax the Bank of the United States in Georgia. And the bank wanted to challenge that tax in federal court. And so they went to court and said, we have a right under the Constitution to challenge Georgia's law in federal court. Even though the provision of the Constitution that the corporation relied on was one that provided citizens with the right to sue citizens of other states in federal court, the corporation said it too was a citizen. And the Supreme Court, while it didn't say a corporation was a citizen per se, it did agree that corporations were protected by this provision. And so from the very earliest days, the Supreme Court's been reading the Constitution broadly to protect corporations and their rights.
So then that developed down the line, and it challenged my understanding of corporations. I had always thought that corporations had to have a public purpose in order to exist, and that they were dissolved once that public purpose had been completed. And so your book suggests that even in the early days, there was this idea of longevity and that they could continue to exist, you know, beyond a normal person's lifespan. How can we understand these two conflicting ideas about what corporations were supposed to be in society?
Well, it's true that corporations were, from the get-go, designed to last. Corporations were first founded in ancient Rome, about three centuries before the birth of Christ, the first form of corporation that we recognize. It was sort of a response to the problem of partnerships. If you lose a partner, the whole partnership has to be reorganized, and it messes with business relationships. So the corporation was designed to create an entity where people could pool their money, and the entity would last over time. And it didn't matter whether the individual investors came or went, the company would go on. So that was part of the basic idea of the early Roman corporation. At the same time, the corporation was generally only allowed to be formed if it had a public purpose, as you say, that of course people could make money on it. The idea was to create a sort of outsource away from government into the private marketplace, the ability to build things and institutions, and corporations are very good at doing that. But and you have to have some private investment encouragement to do that. But they always had to have a public purpose. That really changed, by the way, in a Supreme Court case decided in 1819, argued by the legendary advocate Daniel Webster, who won a Supreme Court case that said that corporations were fundamentally private entities and, like individuals, can make claims on the government for constitutional protection.
Well, since you brought up Daniel Webster, let's talk about some of the lawyers. You said that the corporations, one of their advantages was they could afford and therefore had the best lawyers in U.S. history. So tell us more about Daniel Webster, and then let's talk about some of the other lawyers.
Well, that's right. The Supreme Court is a place in which if you have the best lawyers, you're more likely to win. And over the course of American history, corporations have always had the financial wherewithal to hire the best, most creative lawyers in the entire country. If you think about civil rights organizations or women's rights groups, they often were underfunded. They didn't have the finances to continually bring lawsuits challenging every different kind of case for most of American history. But corporations did have those resources, and they hired the best lawyers. Daniel Webster was considered maybe one of the most influential advocates in the history of the Supreme Court. He argued more than 220 Supreme Court cases in the early 1800s when many of the provisions were first being interpreted. He was known as one of the greatest experts on the Constitution, and most of his cases were brought on behalf of businesses and merchants, and some of his biggest cases were arguing for constitutional rights for corporations and for businesses. And all throughout American history, we see great lawyers playing a really starring role in the fight for corporate constitutional rights. And Daniel Webster is just a perfect embodiment, who was at the time, like I said, the highest paid lawyer in the country, and he could get corporations to represent him.
And there were others that you mentioned. I think one was a guy named Binney. Who was he?
Horace Binney was a young creative lawyer, a legendary lawyer, really, who grew up right across the street from George Washington in Philadelphia, back before the White House was built in Washington. And indeed, Hamilton lived right next door to him, so he grew up around power. And he, in his 20s, became a precocious young lawyer who ended up representing the Bank of the United States in that first Supreme Court case on the rights of business corporations. He was only in his 20s, but he was such an illustrious member of the bar, even at that early age. Binney would go on to live through the Civil War, in fact, and there's photographs of him right after the Civil War, an old man having seen America from its very earliest days to its much later days. But Binney had a creative way of thinking about corporations. He didn't say corporations were people. He said corporations were effectively irrelevant and that the court should look beyond the corporation and protect the rights of the people who associate together within the corporation. And surprisingly, for all the controversy over corporate personhood, Binney's basic idea of thinking about the corporation not as a person but as a pass-through has been much more influential in the history of constitutional rights for corporations.
Now, where would you put Theodore Olson?
Well, Ted Olson is today the dean of the elite Supreme Court bar in Washington. One of the reasons why corporations today are so powerful is that there is a professionalized bar in Washington, D.C. of big firm lawyers who all they do is specialize in Supreme Court practice. And studies show that those cases, lawyers who write those briefs are much more likely to get the court to accept their cases, and they argue an inordinate number of cases before the Supreme Court. And those lawyers predominantly represent big business and corporations, not small fry people and outcasts and dissenters. And so you have today the best Supreme Court lawyers in the country are lawyers who are arguing for corporations, for businesses on constitutional and other grounds. But it also shows, again, the power of the corporations to use the courts to protect their interests.
Did you see when you were writing this book that there had been a shift at a certain point that is significant? And I ask this partly because of, you know, Charles Epps' book, The Rights Revolution, where he talks about the shift from the 60s where the courts started to lean more toward individual rights. Was there a shift like this when it came to corporate rights, or was it consistent over time?
Well, I tell you, the story of corporate rights really is a thorn in the idea that rights talk is recent, because corporations have really been demanding rights and using the same language that we do in demanding rights as immunities from government regulation for a long, long time. And that's why corporations seek constitutional rights, right? Because they want to get immunities from taxes or regulations or other laws that interfere with business autonomy in their pursuit of profit. Of course, there are shifts. I trace a history that goes back to the first colony in Jamestown all the way through Citizens United and Hobby Lobby. So obviously, it's a time of remarkable change in both the nature of the corporation and the nature of our Constitution. But what we've seen is that whenever the Constitution changed to grant broader protections, corporations were always right there. Either they took advantage of those new rights quickly, like in the 14th Amendment context, or in some circumstances, corporations themselves were at the forefront of constitutional change, pushing and innovating the law to protect their own rights in ways that would ultimately filter down to individuals and benefit individual rights too. So it is a complex story of the push and pull of corporations and the Constitution.
Could you give us an example of some of those where it went the other way? So we've been talking more about the co-optation of certain rights that were granted to individuals, then given to corporations. But now you're talking about the initiator, the first mover, where then those got to translate into individual rights.
I think corporations are first movers in at least two ways in the history that I find. Number one, they devise and use innovative civil rights litigation strategies years before the movements for minorities and women do. Things like test cases and hiring all-star teams of lawyers, arguing for a living constitution that extends beyond the framers' intent to embody new principles. These kinds of things corporations were doing a long time ago. Corporations are also innovators in the sense that because they had the resources to challenge laws, they were often at the forefront of judicial cases that really breathed life into some of our constitutional rights. Take the freedom of speech or freedom of press under the First Amendment. Some of the earliest and most important cases were brought by newspaper corporations that were challenging restrictions on newspapers. And the Supreme Court, when it invigorated the freedom of the press, recognized that newspaper corporations had that same fundamental First Amendment right as individuals would have. And indeed, some of the landmark freedom of the press cases we still celebrate today are about business corporations. What is The Post, the super popular movie these days, if anything but a movie about a business corporation asserting its First Amendment rights?
So I wonder about this idea of agency and structure, which we argue about in social science. It sounds like in your book, you're arguing that it's really agency. These are people that are innovating and pushing to change the structure.
It's always a complicated mix of agency and structure, and that there's no one account that you should put all the emphasis on. Especially as the author of a trade press book, you know, I've tried to emphasize a lot of the agency aspects because people love to hear the stories of the particular players. But of course, these are larger structural pressures as well. When corporations are seeking constitutional rights, obviously you need an individual person to make the decision to file that lawsuit. But it's because of larger structural reasons that corporations are pushing back, trying to assert their freedom so that they can pursue their profit. I do think it's a structural story too. And one of the structures is that the institutions of the judiciary, which we think of as being blind to the differences between litigants, and as a really equal playing field for any side in the dispute, is really one in which institutionally it's structured to help and benefit wealthy clients, and corporations are the wealthiest clients around. And so they've really been able to take advantage of those institutions to enhance their power.
I suppose part of that is also related to who ends up on the bench. And one key character in your book was Lewis Powell, who had been at the Chamber of Commerce before becoming a justice. How important is somebody like Lewis Powell or, you know, his brethren, people who ended up on the court in this construction of rights for corporations?
Well, of course, if you want to talk about a field of politics and life where agency really matters, take a body like the Supreme Court, where the vote of one justice really can make a huge difference in Americans' lives. And Justice Lewis Powell was one of those justices. Before he joined the Supreme Court, Powell wrote a memorandum on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce, arguing that it was time for corporate America to stand up and fight back against the rise of Ralph Nader and consumer rights and the environmental movement. And his memo became famous as a strategic document in the rise of the business backlash of the 1970s and 1980s. But he got the chance as a justice to implement his vision in the memorandum. There was an important case involving the political speech rights of corporations out of Massachusetts. And 30 years before Citizens United, Justice Lewis Powell wrote a closely divided 5-4 opinion for the Supreme Court saying that corporations did have political speech rights. And so that's an example of Justice Lewis Powell really having an influence and bringing his vision of the strong and powerful corporation with political speech rights into American lives.
So how is it that we have granted as a society, as an American society, all of these rights to corporations, but haven't really required the same kind of responsibilities? Does any of that make sense?
Well, it is true that we don't have the kinds of social responsibilities and political responsibilities that we've put on corporations that perhaps we should. And in fact, one of the things about corporate constitutional rights is that they often use them to shirk those broader responsibilities. So take an idea that businesses exist to serve the public and not to discriminate on the basis of irrelevant characteristics and create a second-class citizenship. It's one of the things that we really prize about businesses is that they're open to all and we have strong civil rights protections. But this Masterpiece Cake Shop case on whether a Colorado baker has the right to refuse to sell a wedding cake to a same-sex couple. The Supreme Court rules in favor of the baker. It's quite possible we'll see more and more corporations claiming exemptions from civil rights laws and claiming the ability to discriminate against LGBT people and violating that basic idea of free and open access, the kind of responsibility to serve all equally that corporations have traditionally been thought to have.
You know, and that also extends to a case that dealt with whether or not corporations can be sued under certain statutes. And I'm thinking of the Alien Tort Statute at the moment in the Jesner case. And some of the appellate courts have said, no, you can't even sue them under the ATS. So there's this very strange juxtaposition between this, well, sure, we give them all these rights, but no, we can't sue them.
No, I think that's right. And that we're seeing in many ways corporations winning more and more rights and having fewer and fewer liabilities that they're responsible for. For much of human history, corporations were not allowed to be charged with crimes, for instance. But that changed about 100 years ago when there was a real push to say corporations are so powerful, they can form the kind of nefarious intent that the criminal law requires, and we should be able to target corporations when they engage in criminal activity and punish them. And so even back then, there was this idea that we need to hold corporations responsible, hold them liable. One of the things we found, though, is that even when you hold corporations criminally liable, what corporations did then was simply claim the protections of the Constitution's rights for criminal defendants. And we think of the Constitution as being about freedom of speech and freedom of religion, but it's also about the right to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures and a right to due process and a right against a right to counsel and a series of rights about criminal defendants. And corporations claim those same rights.
Let's fast forward to today. A lot of people on the rights front, particularly around campaign finance issues and election integrity, those types of things, have been talking about Citizens United. And there were two things about Citizens United that I thought were important. One was that the lawyer, you said, used Brown versus Board of Education as his inspiration. So I thought perhaps we should start there and then talk about what exactly that case did, if it wasn't really the turning point that others say it is.
Well, that's right. I mean, the lawyer who originally brought that case was a fellow by the name of Jim Bopp, and he saw Citizens United as part of a long pattern and series of cases that he was bringing to try to chip away at federal campaign finance law, at laws restricting money in politics, because he thought that these laws were restricting freedom of speech. And so he challenged law after law after law, and Citizens United was just the latest in a long line of cases brought by Jim Bopp challenging campaign finance laws. He was the one who said he was inspired by Brown versus Board of Education and that idea of bringing successive cases, chipping away at a dominant legal rule to change how the Constitution is interpreted. Again, it doesn't seem like, you know, it's an equivalent move to protect the rights of corporations and moneyed elites, but it was that same kind of rhetoric and the same framing by which he pursued that case. And Citizens United was an important and a groundbreaking case, holding that corporations have the same rights as individuals to spend their money on election ads. That's not equality by any stretch of the imagination. Very few individuals can afford the kinds of ads that corporations can easily and afford every day, filling up our television sets. So it's a kind of false equality. But I do think that Citizens United is the culmination of a 200-year fight for rights for corporations and should be understood in the context of that larger historical battle.
Let's conclude with what all this really means for democratic politics, for U.S. society, and where you think it's going.
Well, I think what this does mean for politics and society is another recognition of the ways in which corporations have asserted power and continue to assert power in the American political system. We often think of corporations as being powerful in the elected branches, in legislatures and among regulators and spending money on campaign finance and on lobbying. But corporations have also been remarkably powerful in the courts, using the Constitution to fight back against regulation. And if we want to understand the nature of corporate power, have to understand the way they use the courts and the Constitution to solidify and to magnify their power. And where are we going? I think actually we're in a period of rising, growing rights for corporations, from political speech in Citizens United, religious liberty in Hobby Lobby. Maybe the cake shop case could open the door for more discrimination by businesses. I think we're at a time of real growth in the world of corporate rights, and we're going to see how it's going to affect society in the years to come.
Well, Adam Winkler, I thank you for joining us here again on the Scholar Circle. The book, again, is called We the Corporations.
When we come back, how does privatization amount to a constitutional coup? Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Privatization of government services has been in place since Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, both who roundly attacked government and civil servants as the enemy. Now, however, the government has become in the service of those who once opposed it. The process has been part of what John Michaels calls a constitutional coup. John Michaels is a professor of law and the author of Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic. Now, you have recently published a book, Constitutional Coup. Coup's a pretty powerful word.
It is. And in fairness, the title was conceived well before the election of Donald Trump, when I would have put much money on Secretary of State Hillary Clinton winning the presidency. Now, obviously, I had time to incorporate what it means for Donald Trump to be the president. But the book is really about the way in which the commercialization of government, the outsourcing of key functions, privatization, all of those features of kind of modern neoliberal government, what you call running government like a business, or whatever the kind of tropes are of the moment. It's been bipartisan, again, since the 80s. Essentially undermines essential rule of law values. It undercuts our separation of powers. And it becomes a tool of heightened executive power. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, I was concerned about that. I started these projects not only saying, you know, thinking Hillary Clinton was going to win. I started writing these projects in the late 2000s when Barack Obama, president, I have great admiration and was happy to have President Obama lead the country. I was still concerned about these trends. These are trends that are partisan. Bill Clinton was a mover in running government like a business. And so the concerns there are really about essentially how commercialization of government isn't just about fraud and abuse of the kind of fiscal sort, which is largely what we've talked about over the years, whether it's military contracting or prison contracting, but it actually undermines central safeguards of our constitutional republic. And that's why I call it a coup, because it completely transforms the way we do everything from welfare services to environmental law to fighting wars to criminal justice. And of course, this has taken on kind of almost cartoonish characteristics in the Trump era, where it seems like, you know, there's very little distance, as it were, between Trump organization, the business operation, and Trump presidency, whether it's, you know, the various Ivanka endeavors or Kushner's real estate deals or Trump talking about, you know, his winery when questions were asked about the kind of KKK rallies in Charlottesville, and his response was, I have, you know, vineyards there. So this has taken on almost cartoonish perspective. And even in the book, I have kind of an optimistic line, which is when we kind of see our way out of the current moment, it might be an opportunity. There might be kind of a bureaucratic renaissance where we realize that some of the folks who kept this country going were the bureaucrats, and we start investing more heavily in a professional civil service. I'm not sure when we get to that point, but that's, again, the kind of ultimate goal, because the civil service provides a very meaningful and powerful check on political agency heads that often represent 48% of the country.
But that's when people are interested in the truth. So, like, when
yes.
So that's a clear distinction between what we have now and what we may have had under previous presidents. I mean, to some degree. I recognize
right.
that there's degrees to all of this, that it's not black and white.
That is true. But my theory on why we need to have what I call in the book administrative separation of powers is because the concerns that I'm raising under Donald Trump's watch or under George W. Bush's watch are just as important under a Barack Obama's watch or an Elizabeth Warren. Because if you're really worried that a president who wins with a good win these days is 49-50% of the population, because we're so divided, and if some third candidate runs, that's why no one can get to 50. And all of a sudden, the levers of government shift from the right to the left, and all of a sudden our regulatory policy kind of flips on its head. That's disruptive to everyone. We don't have a parliamentary system where you get, okay, the conservative government's out, the Tory government's out, and now we're going to have a Labor government. Everything's going to change on a dime. We don't have that. For one, it's not our culture. You know, it's not just, forget about our constitution, it's just not our culture to be like that. But secondly, we don't have a fail-safe for that. Because if a Labor government takes the country too far, the government collapses. We have to wait.
Yeah.
We have to wait sometimes 4 really long, hard years for another crack to change the president and therefore to change the direction of ICE or the direction of the Pentagon or anything else. And so my position really, I think, is a position that should appeal to those who believe that the center matters and the center holds. Even though I'm not a centrist politically, I think the center is key to our political culture and to our legal culture.
So let's shift just a bit into the argument that you're making about privatization harming the Constitution, the country. Now, it's clear that once you privatize something, that the democratic control is gone because it's not transparent in the same way that government is supposed to be transparent. People don't really have a say over a private corporation in the way that they do over government that they collectively own. But what about this rule of law argument that you made just now? How does it undermine rule of law?
So privatization is a complicated issue. So one of the concerns principally about privatization is the government turns over some responsibility to the contractors and the contractors just run with it. And that is a concern about abdication of government power. That is central and that's well known. I'm also concerned about a second type of, let's say, reconfiguration of government power, and this is where the rule of law comes into play as well. A lot of times, the political leadership of the agencies doesn't like the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy is slow. The bureaucracy is obstinate. The bureaucracy is going to say, well, that doesn't really, I understand that's what the president campaigned on, but it's not really comports with the statutes that were that empower us. It's not consistent with our appropriations. It's not consistent with our best scientific understanding. And there's a lot of frustration, a lot of stickiness. And I celebrate that friction because the friction between the political leadership of agencies and the civil servants in some ways reproduces the friction that we hope to exist between Congress and the president. A lot of friction is at the center of our sense of liberty, our sense of pluralism, because it allows more voices to have a say. It does slow things down. It's maddeningly frustrating. But in the 20th century, legislation, so Congress has taken a backseat to agencies. Rules promulgated by agencies become much more central. Think about the environment. We're working off of statutes that are old. The Food and Drug Administration, we're working off statutes that were progressive era statutes. Ever since then, Congress has kind of taken a backseat and the agencies run with it. So if you now have a political leadership that wants to push, let's say, an FDA agenda in a certain direction, let's say, to make it really hard to get over-the-counter or even prescription birth control, as we've seen in various fights, it makes it really hard to do that. That doesn't necessarily match with the best science. You want the pushback. You want the friction. And the civil servants say, no, boss, I can't do that. That's not consistent with our statutory responsibilities to work through the best kind of scientific evidence, and it's not going to be reasonable, and the courts are going to reject it. And so this goes on. Every president doesn't like the civil service. Obama, Clinton, Truman, Eisenhower, whomever. And privatization has now become a backdoor way to get around the civil servants because the contractors are yes men and women, because the civil servants are tenured. You can say no to your boss and show up the next day and get your paycheck. A contractor who says no to the political leadership too much is going to wind up having his contract canceled. So they're going to be completely compliant. And I say the concern isn't runaway contractors as much as it's super compliant contractors, because we lose that friction, that tension that really is at the core of our constitutional regime. So that's why I think it's a basic rule of law question. Once Congress has given the power to the agencies themselves have to be subject to checks and balances. And those checks and balances, as best conceived, is understood between independent civil servants who are professional scientists, economists, social workers, and the politicos who run the agency. And you want both. You want the political and you want the depth that we talked about before. And you want them to have to kind of work out their compromises in the same way that you hope, and that happened in previous eras, that Congress and the president work out their differences.
In an online conversation, you referred to privatization as a weapon of the bullies.
Okay.
Who are the bullies?
The political, the agency heads.
Okay, so the
appointees. Well, I'm not exactly sure what the context was for that.
Key weapon of the bullies.
So it's those who want to essentially enact their policies without following the procedural and substantive hurdles that our Congress and the courts have put into place to make sure that government remains limited and non-arbitrary. It's a shortcut. It's a way to essentially push out civil servants or to scare them. Because once privatization is pervasive as it is now, you don't actually have to use it anymore. The weapon exists because if you're a group of civil servants who like your jobs, now you can't get fired because of your job, but your job could disappear if they find contractors to do it in your place. So if I'm a civil servant sitting at my desk, am I going to push back in a world in which privatization is so rampant and non-controversial? Or am I going to essentially be that the same compliant actor because I don't want to draw the wrath of a political agency head who is very comfortable and very skilled at privatizing? So I think that's what I meant in that context.
So it's a bit of a chilling effect.
Really. Oh, I think it's a quite profound chilling effect. And in my book, I refer to Potemkin civil servants who are basically, it says, hey, look, we have this type of meaningful friction between agency heads and civil servants because on paper, they're still classified as civil servants. And on paper, they still have, you know, plenty of legal responsibility. But they look around them and everyone else has been out, all their friends' jobs have been outsourced. They're not going to actually play that role of a fierce civil servant. And it's gotten even worse today. So even outside the privatization, all this rhetoric that they're disloyal, they're deep staters, whatever you want to say about them. Secretary Zinke gave a speech to a business community basically saying that a third of his agency, the Department of Interior, is disloyal to the flag. So there's all sorts of like whistleblowing with the flag saluting. There's all that dog whistling about flags and disloyalty about that. But we haven't seen rhetoric like that since McCarthy. And so again, if you're a civil servant today, your morale is probably in the gutter. And it's hard, you know, you say, well, why don't they all quit? A lot of them, you know, they're 55 and they have kids in college and they want their pension. It's hard. But we also see people leaving in unprecedented numbers. The State Department, you know, and it's places where people have the most marketable skills elsewhere. You'll see that they'll leave first, of course. So to me, it's a problem, and it's getting worse, at least in the short term.
You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking with UCLA law professor John Michaels about the future of the Supreme Court, given Donald Trump's new appointment.
You mentioned earlier Reagan, and I know in your book you also talked about Margaret Thatcher and the phrase she used of nanny state.
Yeah.
And how there was this push to maybe reduce government or make an enemy of government, they calling it the nanny state, but then a move to then put it in the service of something. What is that?
So Reagan ran for office essentially saying he was going to, you know, cut Washington down to size, and he was going to strip the EPA of its resources and the Department of Education and all these kind of grand ways of basically making government super duper small. Then he gets to Washington, and all these people who said, yeah, yeah, great idea, they all kind of wanted to protect their little basically pots of services. And so they got a lot of pushback. And Reagan wasn't able to cut the EPA. In fact, spending rose under his administration. Certainly military spending rose, but even domestic spending rose and employment rose. But he wanted to cut taxes. He did cut taxes. So we have this escalating deficit. Military spending's through the roof. He can't control domestic spending. So folks at various kind of conservative think tanks said, hey, why don't you try this other idea? It's not exactly what they're doing in the United Kingdom. Because in the United Kingdom, the government-owned state enterprises. They owned Jaguar. They owned, you know, British Petroleum. Those were all state-owned enterprises. We didn't have that. So when they talk about privatization there or privatization in Latin America, it's selling off the telecom companies. We don't have that here. Those were always in private hands. When we privatized here, they said, okay, we're going to cut out civil servants and we're going to hire contractors who are cheaper, don't have benefits, essentially the same casualization of labor we see throughout the economy. At that point, it was largely it was an ideological tool, but it wasn't with a particular political move to change the substance of government. It was a kind of a cost-cutting measure. And then the Clinton Gore team ran with it. And what I say in the book, in some ways, you know, Reagan is often seen as the kind of critical figure, but in some ways the most important figure is Clinton, because Clinton takes the idea that was, it seemed to be a hard right, ideological, anti-government perspective by Ronald Reagan, and mainstreams it and defangs it. So it's no longer this, you know, hostile to Washington. This is all now smarter government, technocratic government. And basically makes it seem palatable to bipartisan audiences. Then they realize this bureaucracy is really stubborn. And we see more as contracting becomes more and more pushed upwards. So it's no longer low-level jobs, no longer functionary jobs. But now policymakers are being contracted out. This is great because they can kind of match, we can have them follow our orders in a much more, expeditious fashion than civil servants who might say, I see what you're saying there, but that doesn't, you know, again, I'm just going to say the same thing, but maybe it doesn't support what the law requires. Maybe it's not consistent with best scientific evidence. Maybe it's cutting some procedural corners, because civil servants don't work on political timetables. They're not, and they shouldn't be thinking about midterm elections. And so they could say, this is actually going to take 2.5 years to be done. And then the politicos say, I know, but we have to run for re-election in 6 months. And that's where these conflicts are produced. And then in the 2000s, it just takes off. And so the debasement and the marginalization of the civil service, again, cuts out this really important set of you know, important legal and political players in our national landscape. And again, you say, civil servants, bureaucrats, I don't see any. I don't see they're mentioned in the Constitution, and I get that. But in the 20th century, we have vast delegations of legislative power, which is supposed to be, if you look at the Constitution, done by the legislature. And now all these responsibilities are being delegated to agencies. Agencies become the critical kind of locus of policymaking, not just at the federal level, but you see the same thing at state level. You see the same thing in any large municipality. Agencies are the main kind of drivers of public policy today. And so we need to think about that space much more carefully than I think we have in the past. And in doing so, it's important to recognize and kind of and credit the role played by the civil servants, that they're not marginal players, they're not illegitimate players, they're meaningful players that have a role, not the dominant role, but a role in the process. And that's why I think if we're going to extend the rule of law to administrative agencies, then we also have to think about what role the civil servants play. And it's much, much bigger than you would understand from reading the Constitution, which doesn't adequately reflect all the dynamics of our current legal political republic.
So from nanny state to sort of nanny corporation.
Yeah.
So you didn't really talk about the corporate side of this so much just now. How would you incorporate that now for us to understand that?
So my book is much more about the kind of Republican values and smaller Republican values.
Meaning
commitments to rule of law, commitments to checks and balances.
Like the Republic.
The Republic. And Republicanism is different from kind of direct democracy. Our country has democracy, but it's leavened by some counter-majoritarian checks. Of course, being one of the critical ones, being a less than, you know, fully responsive Senate because it only gets elected every 6 years is another one. And to me, the civil service is right up there with it. So the book really is a constitutional argument, and it's a constitutional cultural argument as well. There's a whole other side, which is the kind of corporate kind of coziness and rent seeking and extravagant profits that are essentially secured because there's a lot of money that the federal government has. And when we're in Iraq and Afghanistan and they're throwing the money out, you could be sure that some of the contractors are putting some of it in their back pockets. The reason why the book doesn't focus on that in part is because I think journalists have done such an effective job of detailing it. Now, whether it's moved public policy is a separate question. But to me, that angle of privatization is well documented and well rehearsed. If you watch things like 60 Minutes or you read the New York Times, you have a decent sense that contractors can be really corrupt. What I wanted to do is talk about, hey, even if this corruption were put under wraps, even if we could control the corruption, there's a different problem. And arguably, for my purposes as a constitutional lawyer, a much bigger problem, which is this undermines our rule of law. So the corporate part is incredibly important. But it's in part, it's a story that that has been told, and more importantly, it can be a distraction. If all we think about the contractors as being greedy, we forget about how actually compliant they are in order to be so greedy. The best way to be a good contractor is to say yes all the time, so you get more and more contracts. That's the best route to being profitable.
So the other thing that you suggested was that in the Trump era, there may be finally a pushback because he and his team have been so brazen. So what do you think might happen?
Well, so that's the big question. What would happen, and just as importantly, I think, is when, for those with some impatience about, you know, what's going to happen next, and I share that. The question is essentially what happens, how does the country come back together, and what is the agenda going forward? And I think if we get to that point and there's some kind of catharsis, some kind of, I don't know if it's truth and reconciliation or whether there's prosecutions, or we just move on and just kind of forget about it. What is the process in which we kind of shore up the weaknesses, the vulnerabilities that have been exposed? Again, I think the country's strong. I think we've done in large part a really good job of keeping ourselves together as a nation with an old and very flawed document as our backbone. But there certainly needs to be much more extensive disclosure requirements for financial holdings, much deeper and easier to enforce conflicts of interest laws. And again, I think we need to do much more to shore up to secure a viable, attractive civil service that will get people to go into this job, which is going to be a hard task itself. You know, why would anyone want to go into the civil service today? I get that from my students all the time. Those are hard questions. They're going to take decades probably to fully kind of right this ship, as it were. Again, that wasn't necessarily what happened after Nixon because everyone closed ranks and we got reforms right afterwards.
Well, we had a divided government too.
We had a
media that was not divided, and we had a government that was.
We had a government that was, and we had a Democratic landslide, which helped. But Republicans, I think, were also chagrined at that point. And so they did their job too. I mean, there were certain things that were, you know, we had congressional overrides of presidential vetoes, which meant you had to have Republican support. We don't get that anymore. So there has to be a political cultural change, a political cultural awakening or recognition before we can get any type of meaningful policy change, because we're going to need to do so through legislation or regulation.
Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. It's just been a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
John Michaels is a professor of law and the author of Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.